WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmieg is brilliant, and R. Paul Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Edition of the Dustbin of History. Dive on in. No. Lost Gene Shepherd once again from the Gary Hines collection. Asleep on the Air from Tuesday, March 12th. Why, this very day in history, 1963. Shepherd will discuss dynamic culture in America, humor versus comedy, comparing humor of cultures and stars. And we close with a story about a radio station he worked at with a guy on before him fell asleep at the mic for 17 minutes. And trust me, it can happen. Lost Gene Shepherd, available nowhere else but here in the dustbin of history. WBAI, New York, March 12th, 1963.
Are you aware that there is another devilish contrivance being prepared for the bedevilment of the poor, ordinary, common, bedeviled citizen today? That not only has the jukebox fastened itself like a confounded barnacle on the soul of the sensitive man, but now they are preparing a little device that will enable the yokels, the people, the dime droppers into the slaughters. It will enable them to slice off television programs in 3-minute bits. Yeah, have you seen those things where you drop a dime in the slot and they get 3 minutes of I Love Lucy sent to everybody in the joint, inescapably, and then it stops. He drops another dime in the slot, another 3 minutes of I Love Lucy, and then some guy 4 or 5 booths down prefers to see 3 minutes of Ben Casey. So he presses his button, drops 3 minutes in the slot, and you get 3 minutes of Ben Casey. And then there's the intellectual down at the other end who wants Channel 13. And you get 3 minutes of Pablo Casal. And then, oh yes, you know, oh no, never us. We'll never get us on there. But the thing, this presents a very interesting picture of dynamic culture in America. Spreading, moving out, reaching. It has all the elements of the true cubist at work. Within 3 hours, you can probably see a tiny, just a little smidgen, a slice, a sliver of almost anything that has ever happened in the world. Somebody getting belted at 1870 in Cheyenne. You just get that. And then there's a switch to Pablo Casal, hunched over his cello, working away. And then it goes off. And then on comes Chet Huntley, grinning out at you, and he says, and there were 75 people drunk, and then whoop, out it goes, and then there's another quick shot of Pablo Casal, and then a very nice instant survey that, but then again, of course, it only fits. Would you please bring on, come on, Walt, it all fits, because, no, wait, hold on there just a minute, I'll give you the cue, a direct cue, son. All right, here it is. Hello there. This is Dwight Eisenhower greeting you.
Oh, Walter, stop it. Hold it there.
That's how visitors are welcomed at the Eisenhower Birthplace State Park near Denison, Texas. Eisenhower himself, on an endless tape, says, "Hello there, this is Dwight Eisenhower greeting you." On tape. The former president personally dictated his recorded message, which guests hear through an antique wood wall telephone. Eisenhower goes on to say, "I was born in this house. While you are visiting here in Denison, I hope you will pause to contemplate for a moment the history of this great state of Texas and its importance to our great country." Answer. Signed, Friendless. Well, somehow I like the idea of a recorded president coming out of an antique wood telephone to the visitors to the birthplace. If we could get Raymond Massey now to do his celebrated Lincoln, I wonder how they would handle George Washington. Have you ever been to Valley Forge? There's a fantastic possibilities here. Seriously, friends, you don't realize this. You go into Valley Forge, which has right there on the grounds George Washington's headquarters. Can't you hear George Washington on a recorded endless tape coming out of this 18th century chiffonier? And it says, "This is the father of your country. I am personally pleased to greet you here as you now visit..." And then you stand outside the Lincoln Monument and you hear, "Four score and 20 years ago on these..." This is the great emancipator now speaking to you. We would like to also say, have you stopped to consider the great importance that this city of Washington has on the history of your country? Friends, this is Millard Fillmore speaking to you from his home in Garfield, Ohio. And I certainly would like to greet you here, and I'd like to also put in a plug for my friend Rufus Jones down on the corner there, who sells postcards showing the beauties of Garfield, Ohio. Only in America would we have wired monuments. Taped, wired. This opens up a tremendous area for research. Do you know that one senator, seriously, one senator recommended to one of the houses of Congress, I believe it was a senator, it might have been a house, no, it was a senator, by George, recommended to Senate that they have Mount Rushmore wired. You know where they have these guys carved in the great stone there? Yes, I'm not kidding you. The guy wanted all the visitors to come there to hear the voices. Of course, there would be suitable echo chambers, since you have a mountain involved there. That's a little bit bigger than just the Lincoln Monument. It's a little bit bigger than an antique wood telephone. And it would be kind of nice to hear echoing throughout those valleys there, those great snow-covered peaks, and that great stone face, and to hear it all coming in an enormous stereo system. Of course, it would be stereo. You might as well use the whole thing here. And George Washington himself, those great stone lips, telling you the history of our country in, well, Reader's Digest ease. Let's say in 7 easily assimilable sentences. "Our forefathers landed upon these hallowed shores of fields of waving grain. Liberty, justice, the American dream, the American way of life. Those great settlers who, forsaking all creature comforts, moved west. Yes, you Americans today, and I, the father of the country, greet you, and I say to you..." There's a lot of possibilities, tremendous amount of possibilities. It reminds me of that Vic and Sade story. I remember Vic and Sade with Mr. Bullard, who was the founder of the Sacred Stars of the Milky Way, the great lodge to which Vic Gook belonged. And he had a picture, a portrait, a hand-painted portrait of Mr. C.G. Bullard, who had founded the Sacred Stars of the Milky Way. But what set this portrait up above, way and beyond all other portraits that I've ever heard of? The eyes lit up. Now, they lit up but there was a, yes, you see, the portrait was mounted on a handle that could be carried. You see, you could carry it, holding it in the air, like a peace sign, you know, one of the signs that says, repent or something. And you could carry this in a parade, and when you reach crucial moments in the line of march, like if you're in front of the dime store or something with a lot of people, you press the button and the eyes light up. Both of them, that wonderful electric blue that Mr. Bullard was noted for in his lifetime. Somehow I've often wondered about the, there's a peculiar kind of necrophilia that, that runs through so much of our admiration of monuments. Have you ever really read stories about the thousands of people gathering every day in Red Square in Moscow, filing past a leader who was embalmed? How many years ago was Lenin embalmed? Somehow, there's a strange thing. And did you read the issue of Life magazine when they talk? Yes, I mean, it is scary. To me, this is one of the most scary, subtle, most difficult to explain parts of all of us. I guess we don't believe anything really happened unless we can see it there. I'm sure that to a large number of us, including me, Washington is something, well, like Aesop's fables now. It's a giant, unreal thing out of a story. It doesn't have any relationship to real things, you know, like people sitting around and scratching and blowing their nose and looking out of the window and yelling at each other and having a sore knee. It just doesn't fit. I mean, I do not see Alexander the Great in that context either. So, you know, I mean, in the context like Charlie, like, I know a guy named Charlie. Well, I don't see him sitting next to Alex. It just does not fit. So I can understand intellectually, but I don't know what I would feel like if I was walking past a plastic cube in which was preserved Alexander the Great, exactly the way he was, looking out at you with his battle axe next to him, you know? And those piercing blue eyes looking out at you, about to assemble around him the empire of the Mediterranean world. I don't know, you know? And yet this is constantly done. I remember, you see a lot of this in Europe, a lot more in Europe than you do here, believe it or not. But we're coming that way. Did you read the article in Life here a few weeks ago about removing Lincoln from his tomb? Did you read that article? Well, I'll bet it crossed a lot of knuckleheads' minds that they would like to see him do it again. I'll bet it did. I'll just bet it did. And I'll bet many a letter to the editor came in saying, you know, that's a good idea, Life magazine. And as a matter of fact, I think it would be a fine idea to sell a lot of war bonds and to make a lot of youngsters realize that we are living in the great American Republic, and to make them know that history really was a living thing. If we dug Mr. Lincoln up and sent him on a nationwide tour, Mr. Lincoln, I'm sure, would be the very first one who would agree to such a thing, because it would help the country and it would... Whew, I'm serious. I'll bet it crossed a lot of people's minds. This whole thing. It's a spooky. But yet we accept the idea of a recorded president's voice greeting us at a national shrine. It's intriguing. I'm not saying it. Of course, we're a strange folk anyway. Speaking of strange folk, this is WOR AM at FM New York. But one thing that sets Americans apart from most other people that I've seen in the world, and I guess it's hard for anybody who hasn't been in other parts of the world to understand it, but Americans are the most continuously self-critical people I've ever seen anywhere in the world. Are you aware of that, Walt? Oh, they really are. I'm talking about self-critical in that there are very few guys who there are very few countries where a whole class of comics, writers, playwrights can earn their entire living, reputation, and be wildly applauded for doing nothing but the majestic put-down of their own country, you see. Very few countries do this. Now, the English have a sense of humor about themselves, but not about being an Englishman. Not really. An Englishman will put down England, but he will put down England like, let's say, a New York Yankee will put down the Yankees. You know, you put it down that way, knowing full well he's a Yankee. You know the difference there? Like a Met, however, putting down the Mets is in a completely different situation. I mean, you know, he's liable to get fired, you know, for doing it. And he's it's a very interesting difference there. And I read a lot of English publications, and the English have rightly. You know, it's funny. Are you a fan of, if you're a real humor fan, I'm not talking about comedy fan, a humor fan. I'm continually surprised at the people that other people seem to find funny. For example, I rarely find a French movie humorous. I quite often find them funny. They're good at comedy, but humor is never and hasn't, to me, has never been a Frenchman's forte. Not humor. Now, on the other hand, I find the English are terrible at comedy, but they're great at humor. Their humor is fine. Now, there's a difference between humor and comedy. Americans like to make them one thing, you know, to put together. They're not at all. It would be interesting to look up the words and find the difference there. There are very distinct differences. And you can, for example, you can be a comic totally without humor. You see, you can. And there are many comics who are working who are totally humorless men. And their material is totally humorless. And yet, on the other hand, you can be a totally witless man and be a comic. In short, have no wit at all. You can be a good technician. You can have a lot of funny lines and jokes, but that doesn't mean you are a witty man, a man of perception, a man of wit, a man who can see the ironical, constantly repeating, constantly building. I suppose you might say, what is the plural of paradox? Paradise? Yeah, well, I've been there too. But funny thing, I rarely ever find, again, I might go even further, I rarely find the Italians humorous people. Funny, yes. Humorous? No. They take themselves very seriously. They really do. In spite of the fact that you hear them singing and yelling and hollering, I'll tell you what the difference can be. I suppose the difference in the end is this. You never hear an Englishman putting down, let's put it this way. There are certain people who cannot accept the society in which they live. Now, I'm trying to say something here that's not easy to say. On the other hand, I find somebody like Bergman, Ingmar Bergman, far funnier in a truly witty sense, humorous sense, than people who work hard at it, say the French, when they're turning out a comedy. Now, it depends on what you call humor, you say. Again, that's a very difficult problem. Now, you say, why? You say you don't find Bergman funny? Well, I'll tell you. Bergman, did you see Smiles of a Summer Night? Now, Bergman's humor is humor of great style. You see, great style, and he's taking often a very tongue-in-cheek attitude towards all of mankind, which really, in a sense, is the essence of humor. Comedy, usually, is concerning itself with a specific incident. It has nothing to do with all of mankind, per se, although it may often seem to be. And so, a guy swatting another guy on the head with a salami is a specific incident. You understand what I'm saying here. Now, speaking of humor, here's an example of unconscious humor, you see. Oh, then again, it may be conscious. I don't know. I think what I need is a little, on the far one, just no, the far side. That means the far one. There you go. All right, now. This is from the Albuquerque, New Mexico Daily Paper. I read to you now an article printed from the Associated Press, Dallas, Texas. I suppose I should give a Dallas, Texas accent. Dr. Billy Graham, the globe-girdling evangelist, said here in Dallas he can't go along with all the current talk that religion is on the skids. If anything, the 44-year-old Dr. Graham, in an interview here in Dallas, says the post-war religious revival is greater and more sincere than ever. Right next to that, in exactly the same space, right next to that column is one headed Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The Atomic Energy Commission has offered to provide fallout shelter space at all three atomic plants for all of the city's 27,000 residents here in Oak Ridge. You do not see the connection between this and religion getting more sincere and widespread. Now, this brings up an interesting point. A very interesting point. Now, I know. Oh, speaking of humor, one thing I've discovered about humor, in case you're interested in humor as a field of endeavor, that everyone thinks humor is great as long as it's other guys you're laughing at. Now, that's really not humor at all. That's comedy. In short, if you're laughing at Bob Hope having trouble with somebody in one of his skits, you're laughing at Bob Hope. If you're laughing at Jack Benny pretending he's 39, you're laughing at Jack Benny. But if Benny suddenly looked out of the screen at you and says, "Yeah, you think that's funny? What about the thing you're trying to pull on the public, Dad?" Then all of a sudden it's humor. and then look out, you see. Then there'd be a mass tuning out of Benny. Because he's dealing with something there that is a little wider than just whether Benny's pretending he's 39 or not. Now, an example of that is there is an unspoken thing among humorists, among people, for example, who feel that they have a specific grasp on the civilization. Now there is a whole group of people, for example, today, there's a new thing growing. There's the talented, untalented people. Now, the talented, untalented people are the great group of people who years ago were merely spectators on the arts, who went to the operas, who looked at the paintings, who enjoyed the books that artists wrote, but who today have changed subtly into something very different. That looking at somebody else's paintings, looking at somebody's opera, listening to someone's music, almost by definition makes the looker, the viewer, or the listener an artist himself. That many people, because they have an appreciation for art, or I hate to use the word art, let us say whatever it is that we call art, has an appreciation, he feels that somehow he is an artist too. In short, it's the non-arting artist, or the untalented talented. In fact, we've even come to the point now where certain records are billed as records for the talented listener, presuming that Thelonious Monk will rub off on you. Many a guy feels that Ornette Coleman is blowing it for him. Many a person really does feel that J.D. Salinger is just writing it for him. That if he ever got around to it, and if he could ever take time off from the coffee shop and ever get that chick off of his back, he could have just as easily have written "Raise High the the Beams" or whatever it is. You know, I mean, the difference between him and Salinger is infinitesimal, really. In fact, it doesn't exist. Well, this is an interesting new thing that's sweeping through America. It's a kind of do-it-yourself art. That has nothing to do with painting by the numbers either, you see, because the real do-it-yourself artist doesn't do any of these things. He doesn't paint, he doesn't write, he doesn't, in fact, often doesn't even read the things he talks about, which is, I suppose, carrying it one step further, that he can be a Zen Buddhist, for example, without either being a Buddhist nor knowing anything about Zen. it's a kind of, it's a new thing. It's growing. It's a fascinating development in our time, but there it is. Oh, speaking of developments, while we're at it, we might as well do our commercial here. The Paper Book Gallery, which is down on 6th Avenue, just off of 8th Street in the Village, still has a wild collection. Oh, by the way, among other things they have there, they have a complete back file of The Realist. It's the only place that does. They have gotten some kind of an exclusive with Krasner. And that means that if you want back copies of The Realist, including all the various impolite interviews, including the one, apparently they have some of the one that they did with me, which was a wildly strange thing in my career. Yeah, did you ever see that thing? Well, yes, it is. You will find it on sale at the Paper Book Gallery. I think about the attitudes that people have towards humor. And you know you're drawing blood once in a while when you get the outrage scream. that's true. I have never heard anybody scream unless a truth has been uttered. People will laugh at an untruth. They will laugh at it. They rarely scream at it. That when a truth has been uttered, believe me, the bellowings can be heard all the way up to 98th Street and all the way down to Staten Island. Now, that's us. Speaking of the truth, strange things that come out in little newscasts once in a while. Did you hear the story of the guy in the radio station here? I think it was in Wilmington, I believe. There was this guy on the air, an announcer, you know, he was doing a radio show. And suddenly, in the middle of the show, a record ended, and all they could hear was the sound of the turntable going around and the needle in the groove. You know, the sound of shoot, shoot, shoot. Well, yeah, except that this continued for exactly 34 minutes. Nothing but the sound of the record, the thing in the groove there, you see. So everybody got all excited, and they called the cops. They thought the guy had a heart attack. He was the only guy on duty. It was one of these one-man operations, you know, where the announcer doubles as the engineer. And so the police came, and they broke down the doors, and they rushed in, and the guy was sound asleep. His head... What? No, it's Wilmington. I have the clipping right here. It's WJBR in Wilmington. Well, anyway, we'll talk about it afterwards, Kyle, but the point is that he was asleep. That's the point of the story. I don't care how they got in or where the building was or anything like that. That's all detail. The point is the guy was asleep. Well, I got a letter from a listener in Wilmington who says they didn't tell the whole story. Says it was a classical show. And this was an interesting comment in a sort of a snide way about culture in general. That this guy was involved in something that even he could not stick. Well, after a while, he just quietly dozed off in the middle of the second movement, and they never reached the third movement, apparently. Well, I'll tell you a thing that once happened in a radio station where I was working, where the reality is much funnier than the story that you heard here, because this story here, during a record show, could happen. It really could. During records, a record is a record, and it's not exciting. When a man is doing a record show, that is a real comment on canned programming. To me, any record is canned programming. Even if it happens to be a fine recording of a Haydn concerto, it is still canned programming. It's the same sort of thing you can do at home on your own stereo. So I say that the difference between a guy playing a rock and roll record and somebody playing a Haydn quartet is infinitesimal as far as creative radio programming is concerned. However, I don't know what's going on in there. All of a sudden there's a great shuffling going on. But the thing that I once saw happen, and I will allow the radio station in this case to remain nameless, because of, you'll see why when I get to the story. There was a guy, an announcer I knew, who was really more of a performer than an announcer. He was an MC type, was doing a program in the middle of the afternoon in this great big metropolis, this huge metropolitan urban area. Well, now he was on a big radio station. The show had a tremendous listening audience, and it was one of these shows where the fellow sits in the studio with a telephone, and he has the number one jackpot question of the week. you know, that builds up the prize. And each succeeding listener that misses the prize adds another $50 to the question. You know, it's very exciting, the guy where he says, and now, ladies and gentlemen, our number one jackpot question is now worth $750. Can you answer this question? Yes, can you answer this question? Stay by your telephones, because in just 30 seconds, we will make another $50,000 jackpot call. Hold it there. Well, what happened was he was building this thing up. And it was a very exciting show. He had that wild excitement in his voice, that kind of thing. Ladies and gentlemen, I can hear the phone ringing up. There's the first ring. We count these rings, you know. If you don't answer the phone at the end of six rings, we will go on to the next contestant. There's the second ring. There's the third ring. Hey, she's home. And madam, are you listening to the number one jackpot program? You are? Well, now, can you give me the answer to the number one jackpot question? Who wrote Edna St. Vincent Millay's Conversation at Midnight? Oh, I'm sorry, madam. No. No, she wrote Forever Amber, but you were very close. It was a woman. Very close. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we add another $50 to our $50,000 jackpot question. And as a kind of bonus to you, madam, we'd like to ask you a very difficult question. Yes. And if you answer this one correctly, you will receive a $10 merchandising certificate at your friendly Whoopi clothing store. Pick them off the gas pipe racks and save up to 10% on all of your clothing purchases. And now, here is the question. What day is it? Oh, I'm sorry, madam. Well, we'll go on to the next one. Well, it was that kind of a show, you see, this guy did. Well, here's what happened. Very, very sad thing. I'm sitting down in the lunchroom. And the lunchroom is about a block and a half away from the station. I had a show that came on about an hour after this guy's show went off. Now, this was one of those radio stations that was that had a physical setup, which probably is unknown to most listeners, but it was a kind of isolated setup in the sense that the engineer was removed from the man who did the program. He was a good 300 or 400 feet away, like seven studios away. It was operated from master control. And the man had no physical contact with the engineer. He could not see him, you see. Well, he was in a little studio that was all tightly controlled. There was no glass, none of that. Just sitting in there, he had his microphone. He had his the little red sign that would come on that would say on the air. You know, he knew he was on the air and so on. And he had his lists and he had his cue sheets and he had his money and all the stuff that he gave. You know, his telephone. He's in there at work, you see, and he's in contact with maybe a half a million listeners from this little isolated place. Well, the schedule was such at that radio station that he really was the only guy there on the premises at the time. Him, there he was, and his engineer. They were the only ones there. Because the next show that came up, he did an intro. The next show, he make a station break, and they go into the net. So he really was the only one there. There was nobody else around. Well, here's what happened. The program was a one-hour show. And it had no music at all on it, because this guy held it right down. He had 150 commercials, you know, and he's reading the commercials, and he's making the calls, and it was very exciting. And once in a while, he'd tell a little funny story and so on. So about a third of the way into the show, and I'm sitting down at the lunchroom, about a block and a half away, and they have a radio, you know, the kind that's up there back of the cash register, the little old plastic job, and Elsie, the waitress, is running back and forth hollering, and Charlie is back there on the hot plate, and everybody's sitting there shoveling in the scrambled eggs, and the radio just going, you know, nobody's listening, it's just going on, see, so they did this. The reason they had it on all the time is they knew all of us came in there, you know, it's kind of a courtesy, you eat our scrambled eggs, we listen to your junk, so it was that way. So I'm sitting there, and I'm shoveling in the scrambled eggs, and I'm reading the paper, and I can hear, old Max on the air there. See, he's banging it. You hear him die. It's going on in a steady uproar. Well, then there's a moment of silence. Well, I pay no attention. I'm reading the paper, and the silence goes on, and I don't pay much attention to it. Because what had happened was old Max had dialed a number, you see. He says,
now we're going to call a lady out in Clifton. We are calling a Clifton Exchange. All you ladies out there in the Clifton Exchange, get near your telephones. It could be you. Get ready now, ladies. We're calling. We're dialing a Clifton number. Let's see. The first number, the prefix is CI. All you ladies on the CI Exchange, you ready out there? CI6. CI6. S-J-7-G-T. All right, now let's see.
Well, I'm sitting there paying no attention, you know. I figure he's, you know, he's really giving this one a chance. Must be a friend of his or something, see? So I'm reading the paper. I finally look up. By now, I figure the radio has kicked out. I say, hey, Elsie, turn up the radio, will you? She says, oh, for crying out loud, you guys. And she comes back over, and she turns up the radio, and I hear, She says, oh, there's something wrong with this thing. Bang, she hits it. It goes, Just gets louder. And I say, Elsie, will you try another station? And she goes, on comes the other jazz that the other station is doing. Loud, yelling, screaming, giving the time, news, temperature, incessantly. I just turned back quick. And I sit there with egg all over my face. My mouth hanging open. This has gone on now for 5 minutes. It's the sound of a number being rung. And nothing else. Another 5 minutes go by, and I figure something's really happened now. So I throw down a buck. I say, quick, I'm getting out. She says, what's the matter? I said, boom, out I go. He said, I go tearing up the street to find out what's happening. Well, I get down at the station. The station had a peculiar physical setup in that you had to take an elevator to get up there. Well, none of the elevators were available. They were all up on the top floor. So I'm down there ringing the buttons, you know, nothing's happening. It's one of these things, you know, where all the little old ladies are getting off every third floor and going back up one of these automatic elevator things, you know, where you can't. And I'm standing and I'm sweating like mad. You know, I can't figure out what's happened to Max. What happened to Max? Oh, for crying out loud. Well, I must have spent 10 minutes trying to get into that radio station. And I finally get up to the top floor there and I go tearing in. And it's like everything has juxtaposed. The girl who was on the switchboard has taken five. Everybody's out. I go running down the hall and I tear into the studio and there is Max sitting there with his telephone in his hand, held next to the microphone, sound asleep in the middle of his program. And the engineer is out of his skull. He doesn't know what to do. He's down there at the other end, you know, and he's wild because he doesn't have turntables where he's controlling this thing from. There's nothing he can put on. He can throw on the net or something. So he says, and I go in and I quietly take the telephone right out of Max's hands and without even missing a beat, I say, and now let's go on to our next jackpot call. This is Old Shep here. We're going on now. We're going to call a Hillsdale number. We are now at $750. He has slept for 17 and one half minutes right in the middle of that turkey.
Gene Shepherd from this very day in history, March 12th, 1963, asleep at the wheel. No, asleep on the air. That's it. for this edition of the Dustbin of History. We'll be back next week with another one very similar, because we will open with the Weird Circle. We will hear an episode of the Hall of Fantasy, and we will present another Lost Gene Shepherd episode. Got to send a shout-out, which I rarely do, to my pal Jim Clavin, who goes through all of these Lost Gary Hines programs and then uploads them where I can select one for each week. So thanks to Jim Clavin. You should visit his website, flicklives.com, for everything you ever wanted to know and more about Gene Shepherd. I'll be back Sunday night, 8 to 10, with the Golden Age Radio, more women's history stuff. I think we're doing a month of Candy Matson, the San Francisco female detective, Gunsmoke every week, and so much more. So join me then. Thanks for tuning in. This is your curator and janitor for the Dustbin of History, Max Schmid. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. Big deal. Well, I'm going to go back.